The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Tough Ticket. Getting into UNC Chapel Hill from Wake and Mecklenburg is hard, but UNC insists counties don't impact acceptance. And the article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline. Trying to get into UNC Chapel Hill? Depends on where you live. This article is written by Hannah Lang. Clay County, nestled in the southwestern corner of North Carolina along the Georgia border, is home to one of the smallest school districts in the state. Only three schools make up the district, Hayesville Elementary, Hayesville Middle, and Hayesville High. They're all walking distance from each other, about a mile west of the Hiawassee River. The high school is small enough that its counselor, Karen Nicholson, knows where every senior will enroll in college. In 2018, six students at Hayesville High targeted UNC Chapel Hill, and all six were accepted. It was a big year for Carolina, Nicholson says. In fact, Hayesville High has had many big years when it comes to sending students to Chapel Hill. Over the past 10 years, a whopping 69.6% of Hayesville High's applicants have been accepted, one of the best in the state. By comparison, Wake County's public and charter schools combined to have an acceptance rate of 45.9% over the same period. But as Wake County's population is rising, that number has dropped. Last year, Wake County's Carolina acceptance rate dropped to 35.6%. admitted from a sea of more than 2,420 applications. Overall, UNC admitted 39.7% of in-state applicants for the freshman class from public and charter schools that entered in the fall of 2018. The Wake County students who were selected had an SAT score that was about 50 points higher than the in-state average. UNC has long seen itself as an institution that looks to represent the entire state, often trumpeting that its incoming freshmen hail from across North Carolina. In 2018, for example, Carolina welcomed freshmen from 97 of the state's 100 counties. But some significant demographic trends are having an impact on collegiate decisions across North Carolina, and especially at UNC. Over the past 40 years, the state's population has nearly doubled, while the size of Carolina's freshman class has risen only about 26%. In fact, UNC has opened only five new residence halls over the past four decades. Much of the state's growth has been centered in urban areas, as companies and employees have streamed into the state, lured in part by its strong university system. But that means a swelling number of students at Green Hope, Panther Creek, and Sanderson High Schools are casting their hopes towards Chapel Hill, where their applications collide with similar students from Myers Park and Independence in Charlotte, as well as top students from across the state's counties. Other schools are seeing a similar crunch as the state burgeons. NC State University, for example, accepted 56% of applications as recently as 2009. Now that number stands at 43.7% for the entire freshman class that enters in August. But no North Carolina college has the laureled legacy of UNC, and its national recognition is rivaled only by Duke University in Durham. And that, coupled with the current ease of applying to colleges online, has led to acceptance rates that are rapidly dropping. So who exactly gets in? Triangle Business Journal evaluated UNC's acceptance rates for the public school systems in every county in North Carolina over a 10-year period, ending with the class of freshmen who entered in 2018. Over that 10-year period, 48.8% of total in-state applicants were accepted into UNC. And while individual years vary, the numbers show Carolina typically tries to cast a broad net across the state as it builds an incoming class. And that process can work against students from increasingly populous and affluent counties such as Wake and Mecklenburg. For the freshmen who entered in the fall of 2018, a total of 1,417 students in Mecklenburg County's public and charter schools applied to UNC, and about 37% were accepted. Over the past 10 years, the school districts with the highest admission rates to UNC are predominantly rural and on the geographic fringes of the state. These rural counties often account for only handfuls of applications to the school, but statistically, those few applicants from Mitchell, Graham, or Camden County schools have a better chance of getting into UNC than students in the state's most populous districts. Stephen Farmer, the Vice Provost for Enrollment and Undergraduate Admissions at UNC, says the school's mission is to improve the lives of people across the state, and that task crosses county lines. During the admissions process, students are never grouped by county or evaluated in a series of county-by-county competitions, he says. Rather, all students compete alongside all other students from North Carolina. In Clay County, Nicholson knows what to tell her students if they want to make the trek to Chapel Hill for college. If they tell me they're looking at Carolina their junior year, I just say, test scores, test scores, test scores, she says. There's nothing magical. Bigger county, better scores. But it's not quite that simple, as average test scores also vary from district to district. Last year, the average SAT score for all in-state students from public and charter schools accepted to UNC was 1,364 out of a total score of 1,600. But in crowded Wake County, students had to score higher to stand out. The average score for admitted Wake County students from public schools last year was 1,413. Charlotte-Mecklenburg School students were similar, with an average score of 1,400. Those scores are among the 94th percentile of test takers nationwide. At a certain level, such high standards would be expected. Carolina accepted only 22.7% of all applicants for its incoming class of 2018, according to UNC Systems data. And in the past decade, UNC acceptance rates have plummeted 10 percentage points. As the population of the state has swelled, so have the number of applications flooding Carolina's admissions office. In 1979, about 5.8 million people called North Carolina home, and UNC received about 12,000 applications for its entering class of 3,444. Now, the state's population tops 10 million, and space on the Chapel Hill campus hasn't kept up that pace. For the class about to enter this fall, UNC received a record 44,784 applications. The university expects a freshman class of about 4,200. Within the state, the university insists there is no county-by-county quota system. Still, students in districts such as Wake County can find it tougher to gain admission. For example, Pat McCormick's eldest daughter graduated from Cardinal Gibbons High in Raleigh. In addition to UNC, she applied to UNC Wilmington, the University of South Carolina, East Carolina University, and NC State. She was admitted to every school except UNC. I think that the Triangle does have a lot of educated professionals, which means there's a lot of importance put on education, says McCormick, adding, so yes, I think that there's a lot of competition in Wake County. McCormick acknowledges that it takes a lot to ensure admission to Carolina. I don't think you get into Chapel Hill these days very easily, she says. The best chance. So, how can students in crowded districts beat the odds and help ensure their admission to Carolina? Ultimately, it's just presenting their best self in the application so they have the best shot at admission, says Brooke Daly, owner and founder of Advantage College Planning in Raleigh. Daly has helmed Advantage for over a decade, helping local students navigate the increasingly difficult college admissions landscape. Many of her students apply to Carolina and similar in-state options. UNC and NC State, I would say that 90% of our students are applying to at least one of those schools, says Daly. Naturally, when parents are looking at the cost of college, when they see the value of UNC and NC State, they have them on their radar. But in a district such as Wake County, the college admissions process can feel intense, she says. Students can feel like they have to sign up for every extracurricular or rigorous class that fits into their schedule. There are a lot of high schools in the Triangle area that are very competitive, Daly says, and students feel that. Lee Bearer, who directs college admissions strategies in Charlotte, echoes that sentiment. It is a far more overwhelming process than it once was, she says. Building a student base. The UNC admissions office takes a variety of factors into consideration, says Farmer. No student can be defined fully by a single attribute, whether that attribute is a test score, a GPA, or an activity outside the classroom, he says in an email. Our job is to ensure that we understand them in the context of their families, schools, and communities so that we can evaluate them fairly. Farmer says that UNC, like all universities in the UNC system, has a performance agreement with the system involving enrollments and graduations of students with low-income backgrounds and students from Tier 1 and Tier 2 counties, a group of the state's 80 most economically distressed counties, as determined by the North Carolina Department of Commerce. Chris Nordstrom, a senior policy analyst at the NC Justice Center, says inequalities are common across North Carolina school districts. The quality of schools and often the opportunity available to students varies from county to county. A lot of it is driven by the distribution of wealth and resources, he says. These differences mean that students from less affluent regions may find it harder to amass the resume-enriching experiences of their wealthier peers. Family income tells you something about the level of resources families have to do things like go to museums, get supplemental tutoring for kids, take a vacation to Europe, and have a lot of books and computers around the house, Nordstrom says. All of those things that kids from high-income families get that help them succeed. And while UNC may be a highly selective school, admissions decisions are more nuanced than numbers and quotas, says Farmer. UNC Chapel Hill consistently admits the most competitive candidates, both from North Carolina and the rest of the country and world, he says. However, competitive is a complicated idea, and there is no simple or straightforward definition of what constitutes competitive. He stressed that Carolina doesn't use any quota system across North Carolina counties, and that a county-by-county view of things may gloss over some particulars. For example, some students attend schools in counties they don't live in, and the number of applications from each county varies from handfuls to thousands. We try to ensure that strong students from across the state apply to UNC and enroll if they earn admission, Farmer says. We do not consider applicants county by county during the admissions process, and county by county admission rates do not accurately describe either the competition for admission for resident students or tell the whole story about geographic diversity on campus. Other factors in play. It may not be vital or even possible that UNC Chapel Hill grows in tandem with the state's population, says John Quinterno, a principal with South by North Strategies, a research firm based in Chapel Hill that focuses on economic and social policies. As a more selective research university, maybe UNC Chapel Hill does not want to get too much bigger, he says. That doesn't mean there shouldn't be places elsewhere in the UNC system for growth and for other opportunities and to try to keep up and meet the demand for students who want to pursue higher education. Quinterno also points to the fact that UNC receives a large part of its budget from state funding as a reason for it to make sure it says yes to students from across the state. For political reasons, of course, you want to make sure, and also for your mission reasons, that you are admitting students from all over the state, he says. Assuming that, if UNC was going to go to the legislature for budget issues, there would be plenty of people who'd say, why should we help you if all you're doing is admitting Wake and Mecklenburg kids? I'm sure UNC really could pick from a handful of top counties or school districts in the state and probably fill up the whole place with Wake County, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, Charlotte-Mecklenburg students, etc. And of course, I know one of the UNC system's overall strategic goals that UNC Chapel Hill is involved with, too, is that they want to increase enrollment of both low-income and, in particular, rural students. But strategic goals in politics are far from the concerns of families and students who flock to UNC for admissions tours and walk the leafy campus, wondering if they'll get a spot. One admissions ambassador, Senior Colin Williams, says he realizes the admissions process can be this intimidating thing. But the admissions staff, he says, are actually some of the most welcoming people. They want to make UNC the best they can, but they have to work within the limits they're given. Williams, a first-generation college student, came from Davie High in Mocksville, a town of about 5,000 people, and on his tours he received plenty of questions from parents and students about how to get a yes from UNC. The most common one I get is, "What's the secret? What's the secret to getting into UNC?" Williams says, and that's a hard question to try and answer. But 321 miles away in Clay County, they know the answer includes test scores, grades, and geography. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Hadley serves up cheese first and a sweet swing after that. Biz loves cheesy stories, so we perked up when learning that Raleigh golfer Chesson Hadley would serve free food with pimento cheese at a Bojangles in Greensboro the week of the Wyndham Championship. Hadley tied for ninth this year at the U.S. Open and has won nearly $1.4 million on the PGA Tour. His appearance continues a strong local presence at the tournament that began in 1938 as the Greater Greensboro Open. The event is often skipped by the tour's biggest stars, but players with area ties have succeeded, and past winners include Ray Floyd from Fayetteville, Davis Love III, UNC Chapel Hill, Carl Peterson, NC State University, and Webb Simpson, Raleigh. And Vance Hefner, who played at NC State and was a longtime PGA player, was a fan favorite at the GGO with his free-spirited personality. This year's field does include one of the game's best players in Jordan Spieth, and Annika Sorenstam, one of the greatest players in LPGA history, gave a clinic in Greensboro for girls July 29. But did she give out free pimento cheese? Apparently not. Triangle hospitals get high marks in survey. The Triangle's hospitals made national rankings again this year, as well as topping statewide competition. U.S. News & World Report's Best Hospitals report ranks Duke Health and UNC Healthcare among national competition. According to the report, Duke University Hospital took top position for North Carolina, as well as ranking in the top 10 of national rankings for specific specialties. Its highest ranking came for the ophthalmology specialty, which is ranked 7th nationally, but was also lauded for its rheumatology, children's neonatology, and pediatric nephrology, among others. Just behind Duke came UNC Hospitals, which earned 2nd place in the state and some national rankings as well. Its highest accolade came for its ear, nose, and throat, pediatric diabetes, and pediatric pulmonology, all of which ranked 16th in the nation. Following up the state rankings came Vidant Medical Center, Carolina's Medical Center, and Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. Duke's upgraded football stadium lauded for design. In 2014, Wallace Wade Stadium on the campus of Duke University began undergoing a 3-year, $100 million facelift. Now, all of that work has garnered a National Design Build Merit Award from the Design Build Institute of America, announced July 26. Awarded in the education category, the Wallace Wade project included lowering the football field 5 feet, removing the running track, adding seating, and installing a new playing field and scoreboard, and a new 5-story structure dubbed Blue Devil Tower. The Beck Group provided design and construction services for the project. The project will also go on to compete for a National Award of Excellence and Project of the Year to be announced at DBIA's Design Build Conference and Expo Award Ceremony in November. Biz can just imagine Coach Wade peering out from under that fedora, beaming with pride. Here's your chance to land on TV at the coast. If you love North Carolina's aquariums, here's your chance to show it on a broader scale. The North Carolina Aquarium at Pine Knoll Shores will film commercials later this summer, and the aquarium is asking people to submit photos for a chance to join the cast. The casting call began July 31 and closes August 5. The aquarium needs toddlers, teenagers, and people who look up to the age of 70 to show a family tradition of visiting. Filming will take place in August and September. The positions are unpaid, but the actors do get a chance to see the aquarium after hours. Those interested in participating in the commercials can send pictures and contact information to pksmail@ncaquariums.com. GalaxyCon is a hit as fans flock to downtown Raleigh. The calendar for downtown Raleigh is now packed with events, but none is as quirky as the massive GalaxyCon. And this year, 50,000 fans invaded the halls of the Raleigh Convention Center, according to GalaxyCon co-founder Sandy Martin. Many dressed in costume, with even the Incredible Hulk posing for pictures. For many attendees, it was time to do the time warp again as the event showcased the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the film that still delights late-night audiences long after its 1975 release. Many of its stars, including Tim Curry, Barry Bostwick, Nell Campbell, and Meatloaf, met with the crowd and took part in a Q&A on a main stage. On another main stage, Monty Python alum John Cleese answered questions via FaceTime. Cleese had to correct people several times when they pronounced his name wrong. Think cheese with an L. And when one fan asked which of his fellow pythons was the most annoying, Cleese responded, Gilliam, for Terry Gilliam. You can't understand a word he says. Michael Palin, he talks too much. Eric Idle, he was never any good. Terry Jones, he was all right. Iconic barbecue restaurant in Goldsboro may be saved. According to court documents, a new company called Gold Pit Partners has offered to buy the bankrupt Wilbur's Barbecue and Restaurant for $350,000. If approved, it could reopen in September. We are excited about it, says Joseph Frost, the New Bern attorney representing Wilbur's. Of course, it all has to be approved by the bankruptcy court. Wilbur Dean Shirley, who has run the restaurant since 1962, has agreed to provide the purchaser with his expertise and to a non-compete provision. In return, he gets $750 per month as part of the deal. Now, in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Technology and Transportation page, written by Lauren Onosorge. NC growth is great for this local company. Recession recovery, specifically in North Carolina, bodes well for Raleigh's Martin Marietta Materials, which provides the aggregates and cement used in highway projects as well as the overall construction industry. That's according to company CEO Ward Nye, who says the rock crusher is seeing an increase in projects across the state, not just in Raleigh and Charlotte. We're seeing places like Greensboro in North Carolina recovering in a very nice way for literally about the first time in a decade, he says. We think that's incredibly important as Raleigh's been in recovery mode. Has Greensboro lagged? It has, and it's doing noticeably better now. In terms of NC Department of Transportation spending, North Carolina is expecting a record year. And it's not alone. Other states where Martin Marietta supplies stone are also growing. Nye points to Florida with an estimated $10.8 billion in DOT spending, and Texas's budget, which increases to $9.1 billion next year. If we think about really why we have confidence in the continued emergence of public works, it's the customer backlogs and it's the dialogue coming in from the DOTs that gives us that underlying confidence, he says. Not all analysts share the sentiment when it comes to the firm's shares. Within hours of the earnings release, CFRA lowered its outlook on Martin Marietta shares to hold from buy. Although we view MLL's fundamentals as strong and improving, we think MLL shares are likely to consolidate and trade in a narrow range, writes analyst Matthew Miller in a note to investors July 30. He points to the company's pricing growth of 4.6% being more than offset by a 4.9% volume decline, slightly driven by inclement weather in one of Martin Marietta's biggest states, Texas. Coming next summer, East End Connector in Durham. The 3.9-mile, four-lane East End Connector is nearing a new milestone, albeit not the completion date engineers had originally targeted. Last year, engineers with the North Carolina Department of Transportation had hoped the end of 2019 would bring an end to the project, which will connect the Durham Freeway and Miami Boulevard, creating the new I-885 and improving access to I-85 and I-40. But the 2018 hurricane season brought in unexpected delays, says Cameron Richards, NCDOT's resident engineer on the project. Now it's scheduled to be done as early as May 2020. We're hoping around summer of 2020 we're pretty much wrapped up with the project, he says. It's a long time coming, as the initial plan for the connector came out of the 1959 City of Durham Thoroughfare Plan. In 1982, when the Durham East-West Freeway, NC-147, was constructed, limited funding delayed the East End connector indefinitely. But in 2003, the project was added to a list of initiatives eligible for state funding. The ground finally broke in 2015. The next big milestone is going to be getting 147 open, Richard says. Initially, crews hope to open 147 in July, but he says August is more likely. The $142 million project requires 16 new bridges, 4 bridge rehabilitations, and 4 culverts. But if all goes as NCDOT expects, officials hope the new bolstered access provided to the I-85 corridor could promote new economic development opportunities. And included with this article, there's a quote from Joe Malazzo, who is executive director of the Regional Transportation Alliance. The East End Connector is essential for regional commerce and for completing our resilient multimodal freeway network. It will both improve access to downtown Durham while relieving the downtown area from through traffic. Counterculture Coffee closes first funder. Nearly 25 years after it was founded, Durham's homegrown sustainable coffee brand, Counterculture Coffee, has raised its first outside financing, about $2 million. The move not only restructures the company's debt, but gives it a financial cushion to keep growing, says co-founder Brett Smith. He says the company, currently at about 110 employees, had several opportunities before, but we have stayed our course and said no, Smith says. But when Doug Vaughn signed on with Triangle investor Sharpview, it came when the company was rethinking its debt position. Vaughn, who Smith has known since college, was a natural choice, he says. He has followed us for years, Smith says. With the new funding, Counterculture consolidated debt notes it has held with friends and family members, but it also gets extra capital to expand. That includes at soon to open training centers in Miami and Dallas, and new production equipment at its roasteries. IBM faces another age discrimination suit. The pink slip came without real warning, the lawsuit alleges. Former IBM employee Brad Calderon claims he diligently performed during his 18-year career and worked in Big Blue's sweet spot, cloud computing. But according to a new lawsuit he filed in federal court in New York, Calderon's sales title at IBM Cloud Business did not shield him from a layoff, and the suit alleges that the actual reason for Mr. Calderon's termination was his age. The dust has barely settled on IBM's $34 billion buy of Red Hat, and its legal team is busily working to squash this and cases like it in federal court. The suit is one of multiple complaints lobbied at Big Blue in recent years, accusing the computer services giant, which has in addition to Red Hat a large campus at Research Triangle Park, of age discrimination, axing older workers while hiring younger talent. Had Mr. Calderon been younger, and especially if he had been a millennial, defendant would not have terminated his employment, the 8-page suit filed July 29 reads. IBM denied the claim. We make our decisions based on skills, not age, a spokesman emailed. This former employee's claims are false and inaccurate, and we will defend ourselves in court, it said. And finally, in the section called They Said It, these two have different views on Odd Fellow's Lot. We feel confident what we promised we can deliver, Wakestone president Sam Bratton says, now that the bulk of the exploratory analysis is complete on the proposed Triangle Quarry expansion near Umstead State Park. Wakestone has said project yields will mean an estimated $24 million in revenue for Raleigh-Durham International Airport. One person who doesn't buy that is Jean Spooner, executive director of the Umstead Coalition. She points out the only number in the contract is the $8.5 million minimum Wakestone has to pay, even if its yields don't pan out. We all want the airport to succeed. Yet the money, according to the lease, doesn't come in the time frame that the new runway, for example, is planned to be built. So it's a little hard to see when you read the lease how there's any great assistance from this new quarry to the airport's plans, she says. Now we turn to the page written by Seth Thomas Gulledge on healthcare and education. MERS campaign addresses guilt women feel about buying aesthetics. For Raleigh's MERS, selling a quality product line is not enough. It needs to help its customers decide if using those products is perfectly normal. MERS is an aesthetics and neurotoxin company headquartered in Germany, and with its America's headquarters in Raleigh. The company and its competitors have enjoyed a growing market for years. The problem, MERS America CEO Bob Radigan says, is some potential customers see buying their products as a stigma. Many think, if I go spend money on that for myself, I'm being too vain, or it's something I'm not going to be proud of. People are going to say, oh, she uses Botox. That's why she looks so good, he says. Radigan says there is a tremendous latent demand, and adds, If you pick any project or procedure in the medical aesthetic space, it would be hard to find an area where there's 20% penetration of the available market. So MERS launched a marketing campaign to convince women, who are 90% of its customers, that it is okay to use the products. It's empowering women to feel confident and to be their best selves, he says. The campaign urges women to stop feeling guilty about their self-care routines. There's a very large group of women out there who spent the last 10 to 20 years building a career, having kids, raising a family, taking care of a spouse, putting all their time and attention into taking care of others, Radigan says. And now they're stepping back and saying, you know, it is okay and right for me to treat myself to something I deserve and want and not feel guilty about it. The company has branded these customers Reclaimers. The strategy has been incredibly successful so far. Our product had been relatively flat for a number of years, not from the growth standpoint, because the markets have grown, but from a share standpoint, he says. The last 2 years, we've been growing 3 to 4 times the rate of the market. Study: Medicare policy contributes to rising drug costs. A Duke University study is pointing the finger at Medicare policy for the skyrocketing price of drugs in the U.S. According to a paper published in the Review of Economics and Statistics coming out of the Duke Margolis Center for Health Policy, Medicare reimbursement policy may be a major driver of high drug prices. David Ridley, an economist at Duke's Fuqua School of Business and faculty member of the Center for Health Policy, says that since a 2005 Medicare policy change, the launch price of new drugs has more than doubled. It was arguably even worse before 2005, but it's still deeply flawed, he says. Specifically, the study looked at the Medicare Modernization Act's Part B policy to reimburse provider-administered drugs based on past average sales price. The findings showed that in general, the policy made providers less sensitive to the price of the drug when reimbursement covered a portion, and that while they prefer lower prices, they favor the highest pass prices because insurer reimbursement will be higher. Ridley says the study recommends that Medicare should end its cost-plus model because of its effect on driving up price and reducing provider sensitivity to cost. UNC research could bring hope to cancer patients. A breakthrough discovery from the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center has the potential for a new array of therapeutics that could stop tumor growth in non-Hodgkin lymphoma and possibly even more. The new research, details of which were published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, discovered a hyperactive cell signal that contributes to tumor growth in an aggressive blood cancer, says Blossom Demania, Vice Dean for Research in the UNC School of Medicine and co-director of the UNC Lineberger Virology and Global Oncology Programs. She says they have also discovered a protein that blocks that signal, presenting promise for a line of therapies that could inhibit cancer growth. When targeted by researchers, the protein, Tyro3, was found to kill primary effusion, lymphoma cells, and tumors. It's a possible treatment, Demania says. We haven't shown that it cures it, but it does inhibit and prevent its growth, so it definitely has potential to cure. The breakthrough could provide hope to patients who have no current therapies that can stop growth. Demania says it will still likely be several years before drugs based on the findings make their way through clinical trials. To further develop the possible therapeutics, she says the intellectual property has been transferred into Merix, a UNC spin-out. And in a section called Screening Newborns, there's a quote from Richard West, Babies CEO, on the medical technology company's second product launch, a screening system for newborns. We're only a 5-year-old company. We've had an FDA-approved product on the market for just 2 years, so we're making great progress. There will be a time when every baby is tested with one of our products in some fashion or another in the U.S. and a lot of babies elsewhere. And finally, Merck's expansion is more positive news for Durham. With Merck's newest expansion unveiled for Durham, the company's total investment in the county has stretched beyond $1.6 billion, something officials say is having a compounding effect on the county and region, improving lives and enticing more investment from the pharmaceutical industry. Merck has unveiled a $680 million investment in the Triangle, promising to bring more than 400 jobs to the region. The majority of the project is focused on Durham, where the company plans to construct a 175,000-square-foot facility to house production of its Gardasil vaccine, which is designed to protect against HPV. In Durham, where the company already employs 800 workers, Merck is required to bring in at least another 383 jobs to qualify for its nearly $10 million worth of incentives from the state and local governments. The latest news has state and county officials celebrating, saying the expansion is good for Durham as a whole. Almost $750 million improving the tax base in Durham, which is basically lifting everyone's boat, says North Carolina Secretary of Commerce Tony Copeland. Wendy Jacobs, the chair of the Durham County Commissioner, says those dollars not only make new employees' lives easier, but providing the funding for the country to make a long list of improvements. What people really need to understand is this tax base, the property tax, that's how we pay for all of our programs and services, she says. This is how we pay for our schools, social services, EMS. This is how we pay for things. If you don't have the economic investment, you don't have the revenue to pay for things in our communities. And now we turn to On Real Estate, written by Caleb Harshberger. Triangle developer pivots to upscale projects. An established Triangle hotel developer cementing a pivot to larger upscale hotel projects with construction on a full-service hotel in Briar Creek and the announcement of a new hotel planned for Cary. CMC Hotels will soon begin construction on its new Westin Hotel at Briar Creek, a full-service $55 million hotel featuring 233 rooms, 8,000 square feet of meeting and banquet space, and 6,000 square feet of retail located at 3931 McCaw Street at Briar Creek Commons. The Westin is expected to open in mid-2021. Owned by the father-son duo of G.S. Chhabra and Sean Chhabra, CMC Hotel's portfolio includes Best Western, Marriott, Hilton, and Hyatt. Nearby hotels include a Hampton Inn and Suites and an Embassy Suites by Hilton in Charlotte. CMC CEO and Chairman G.S. Chhabra says the company picked Briar Creek for its heavy traffic and potential for future growth. That's been the trend we followed all along, he says. In addition to the Westin, CMC plans a 138-room Courtyard by Marriott off Walnut Street in Cary. The Courtyard will be a $23.5 million project, and site prep has begun. It is expected to open in 2020. CMC Hotels is a privately owned hotel management firm formed in 1985 when it developed and constructed a Best Western Plus at 1722 Walnut Street in Cary. CMC still owns and operates that property. Triangle rental rates up, vacancies continue downward trend. The Triangle saw a boost in office rental rates in the second quarter, while vacancy rates continued to drop as new and growing businesses expand in the market, according to a Colliers International report. The report looked at over a dozen Triangle submarkets, comparing their vacancy, absorption, rental rates, and more. Across the Triangle, Colliers found average Class A office rental rates increased to $29 per square foot in the second quarter, a 40% jump from earlier this year. Rates had held steady for the four quarters before that. Submarkets in downtown Durham, Raleigh, and Six Forks, Falls of Neuse all saw Class A rates exceed $32 per square foot. Offices in the Triangle have already broken the $40 per square foot barrier. Kane Realty announced its $41.50 rate at Tower 4 at North Hills earlier this year. This trend is expected to continue as several proposed projects in downtown Raleigh are expected to ask similar rates, according to a report by Avis & Young. Meanwhile, vacancy rates have continued their downward trend. Colliers found Class A office space across the region was just 7.5% vacant. In downtown Raleigh, vacancy rates were just 3.11%, and West Raleigh saw a rate of just 5.2%. Triad developer plans 86,000-square-foot residential community in Holly Springs. A longtime investor in the Triangle has plans for a 185-unit multifamily development at Holly Springs, Hawthorne Residential Partners, based in Greensboro, has submitted plans for the Hawthorne at Holly Springs community, proposed for 805 Piney Grove, Wilburn Road, just south of the shops at Holly Springs. Units at the Hawthorne will be spread across 7 residential buildings, ranging from 3 to 4 stories tall, with a total of 85,785 square feet. The development would also feature a pool and a clubhouse. Hawthorne Residential Partners. Other properties in the region include Hawthorne Six Forks and Meridian at Sutton Square. Construction underway on massive development. After more than a decade of planning and preparation, construction has begun on a 470-plus acre mixed-use master plan project in Johnston County. Eastfield Crossing is a 2.8 million square foot development stretching between exits 97 and 98 along I-95 outside of Selma. Plans for the site include a 1 million square foot business park, widespread retail and restaurant space, medical services, hotels and senior living, and single and multifamily residential units. Eastfield will also feature a farmer's market and farm-to-table dining options as planners work to design the site in keeping with the area's agricultural roots. AdVenture Development began demolition on the first phase earlier this year. The type of development we want to do is family-oriented, mixed-use, with the goal of live, work, play in a walkable community, owner Kevin Doherty says. And finally, in a section called Growing, measuring downtown Raleigh's growth in 2019. From a new steakhouse to a hemp store and a cocktail lounge, downtown Raleigh has seen a bump in the number of storefront businesses this year, according to the most recent economic development report from the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. Here's a look at the first half of 2019 by the numbers. 20, the number of new storefronts that opened. 15, the number of storefronts that closed. 64, the number of new businesses in downtown since the start of 2018. And 37, the number of businesses that have closed since the start of 2018. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to On Restaurants and Retail, written by Dathan Kazuk. New law could jumpstart NC distilleries. North Carolina distilleries are raising their glasses in celebration after Governor Roy Cooper signed a bill July 29 that changes how that industry is regulated. Senate Bill 290 allows craft distilleries to sell mixed beverages on their premises, thus allowing them to develop cocktail lounges. The bill also lets ABC stores have free tastings of the liquors in areas where that's permitted by the local ABC board. Carrie Joshi, a founder of Social House Vodka, says the new law will be an important step for the industry. Driving trials or tastings are necessary for craft distilleries to showcase our fine spirits for consumers before they have to make a purchase decision, he says. Under the new law, distilleries will now be permitted to provide tasting samples in ABC stores and offer full cocktails at their distilleries. Also critical is the ability to sell the product at distilleries. The new law will allow craft distilleries to build their brand and develop demand for their products before growing wider distribution through the ABC system, a plus for both the ABC stores and craft distilleries, Joshi says. He says Social House is on track to double sales of its vodka this year. Sam Searcy, the chief commercial officer at Greybeard Distillery in Durham, calls the law the next logical step in the industry's evolution. Searcy says Greybeard now has nearly 20 employees and expects to produce 10,000 cases, each with 12 bottles of vodka, this year. He says the company expects to add another $1 million in revenue now that the new law is in place. New bar concept opening in Carrboro. The former Cafe Carrboro at the intersection of Carrboro and Chapel Hill will see new light as an upscale dive bar when it reopens later this summer as 401 Main. Chris Baldwin, who is from Chapel Hill, and Al Bowers of Al's Burger Shack will open 401 Main, a restaurant that will feature seafood, po' boys, draft beers, and frozen cocktails. Al and I have been friends for years, and we've been plotting to open a bar like this for some time, Baldwin says. We're right in the middle of town, and we hope you'll leave your car in the driveway, grab the dog, and head on up for a great po' boy and a beer. Baldwin and Bowers will also serve up their signature sandwich, The 401, a grouper, po' boy with bacon. The bar inside 401 Main will have local and international craft beers, wines by the glass, and special treats for dogs. The renovated space will feature floor-to-ceiling subway tiles and large windows to let in ample light. And finally, Lone Rider is giving patrons a chance to own a cask of bourbon. Lone Rider Spirits has launched its Founders Club, which allows patrons to own a cask of bourbon. The club will be a way for individuals to collaborate with the distillery to create individualized casks of bourbon. A total of 500 casks, which will become the Founders Club, will go into a variety of casks that will include French, Spanish wine, ex-port, ex-sherry, Oloroso, ex-Pedro Jimenez, and ex-bourbon Lone Rider beer casks. The subscription price to become a member ranges from $4,000 to $5,500, depending on the selected casks. A bourbon cask, which starts at $4,000, will yield 53 gallons, while an ex-bourbon beer finishing runs $5,500. Lone Rider Spirits was founded around the idea of creating great bourbon and sharing it with our friends, says Chris Milkey, president of the company. Now everyone gets to participate on a whole new level in creating spirits with the Founders Club. I can't wait to taste these barrels in a few years. Lone Rider Spirits launched in 2018 as a companion to the popular Lone Rider Brewing Company. Joining the club will give an investor options when their bourbon is ready. They can have their beverage bottled, let it mature even longer, or take ownership of the casks for potential sales. Allowing the bourbon to age longer than 5 years can be done for an additional $100 per year per cask. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Huge Gamble from the Fed with Rate Cut. My, how things have changed. Late last year, the Federal Reserve was hinting at a series of rate increases to keep the economy from overheating and keeping inflation in check in case things got out of control. Well, based on the numbers released last week, it looks like the U.S. economy is still strong, although the growth rate has slowed down and the jobless rate remains low. But it looks like many of the policymakers who make up the Federal Reserve, including Chairman Jerome Powell, are now saying cuts in the rate are necessary to reflect the global trade slowdown in a potential environment of higher tariffs. The July 31 decision to cut the rates by 25 basis points was the first since the last recession. If one reads between the lines, it looks like more cuts may be coming in the next 12 months. This is a gamble of mammoth proportions. Frankly, I do not know why some of the leading minds of the American economy have started thinking U.S. businesses are closer to facing some serious headwinds, and this is just one way to make American products and services a little cheaper to the world. That may be true, but we are reacting to what is happening in Europe and China when we should be leading and spreading the gospel of free trade and superior products. Rate cuts at the time when the economy continues to grow mean only one thing. The Fed will have fewer options to implement when there is a slowdown in the economy. Maybe I'm reading this entirely wrong. Maybe the latest set of economic data that showed a 2.1% growth in real gross domestic product, ahead of 1.9% estimate, may have some baked-in headwinds factored in, making Powell and some of his lieutenants nervous about a sharp decline in third and fourth quarter. In the first quarter, GDP grew by 3.1%. What most people fail to realize is it's consumer spending that is keeping this growth curve sustainable. Other than consumer spending, only government spending played a positive role in shoring up our economy during the second quarter. Exports, imports, fixed income residential and non-residential, and private inventories were all down. A rate cut will move money from U.S. Treasuries and short-term bank investments and shift that money into the riskier stock market. I don't have to explain what will happen to those investments when the downturn arrives. When the Fed cut rates following the Great Recession, markets were near the bottom, and buying stocks was an option. But now? Sheesh. The economy slows down if the U.S. consumer stops going to restaurants and shopping malls and defers purchases of the latest mobile phones and gaming consoles. There are no amount of rate cuts that can be put in place to counter that. History shows us that. And that's the thing that worries me the most about the Federal Reserve's action on July 31. And now we turn to the small business section to read Jim Verdonick's column. He is the founder of Innovate Capital Law, which advises entrepreneurs and investors in capital raising transactions. The headline, Digital Currencies Continue to Make Breakthroughs. Crypto skeptics had a great year last year. Every digital asset crashed. But have you noticed that crypto, coins, and tokens have been making a big comeback the last several months? Cryptocurrencies are like all thinly traded markets and subject to wide price swings, but if we focus too much on these fluctuations, we'll miss the big picture, which is blockchain-based products and services are making major commercial and regulatory breakthroughs. Here are three examples. Tezos. Recently, BTG Pactual, a big Latin American investment bank, and Dalma Capital, a Dubai-based asset manager, announced plans to use the Tezos blockchain to launch security token offerings to, quote, address a deal pipeline in excess of $1 billion for existing and prospective token issuances, unquote. That's according to a news release. Blockstack. Like Ethereum, Blockstack is a developer-focused open-source platform. Blockstack is an easy way to build decentralized apps that can scale and claims that more than 100 independent developer teams that have built apps on Blockstack. The U.S. Security and Exchange Commission recently gave Blockstack approval to conduct a $28 million digital token offering under Regulation A, which enables smaller companies to raise money from the public with less strenuous accounting and disclosure standards than a traditional IPO. This is a major change from the days the SEC was saying that all initial coin offerings are scams. This legalized pathway should help U.S. blockchain software developers catch up to their international competitors, who have been able to raise capital without significant regulation. Turnkey Jet. The SEC staff issued its first no-action letter, in which the staff agreed a token to be issued by Turnkey Jet is not a security. Turnkey Jet, a U.S.-based air carrier and air taxi service, can now sell its tokens to the public without complying with U.S. securities laws under very specific conditions. Resale markets essential. Resale markets are the key to digital assets, and the SEC's Division of Trading and Markets and the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, recently issued a statement that explains how broker-dealer regulations apply to the custody of digital assets. We already have a growing set of rules about how issuers can sell digital assets. The sooner we have a clear understanding of how digital asset resale markets will be regulated, the sooner investors can enjoy the benefits of having a greater liquidity that does not depend on the company being sold or doing an IPO. The developing pattern with digital assets is that the technology continues to grow more useful at a steady rate, despite market fluctuations. And in turning to general news, we have an article written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. Region pulls in $1.5 billion through grants, driving growth across the area. The Triangle's research universities and business community are pulling in more than $1 billion federal dollars per year, more dollars per capita than any other region in the entire country, according to recently released data from the State Science and Technology Institute, SSTI, the Durham-Chapel Hill area received $2,059.70 per person in 2018 from the National Institutes of Health, or NIH. The report does not include amounts gathered for various other federal departments. As a whole, the region received more than 2,500 NIH grants in 2018, totaling about $1.5 billion, the sixth highest in the nation. So far this year, NIH has awarded more than 1,550 grants worth about $850 million to the region. UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University were responsible for the vast majority of the funding, bringing in more than 1,700 grants worth about $1 billion. The rest of the fundings and grants went to businesses and organizations headquartered in the Research Triangle Park area. Our rich concentration of excellent research universities in such proximity is significant, even though places like Boston and Philadelphia also boast these kinds of clusters, says Mary Beth Thomas, Senior Vice President, Science and Business Development for the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. Our special sauce, of course, is that we don't have the population crowding our universities, she says. But that collection of research universities is creating a large pool of talent for local companies, as well as university departments, something Thomas calls a funding magnet. We have an unusually high proportion of residents with advanced degrees, and many thousands of them are conducting research of the sort that attracts NIH grant funding, she says. And there's a lot of truly important research going on here. Honda Aircraft begins $15.5 million expansion in Triad. Arguments over which state can truly claim as first in flight notwithstanding, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper told a crowd of about 200 gathered for July 30's groundbreaking of the latest Honda Aircraft Company expansion that being first in aerospace industry growth is inevitable. First in flight has a new meaning in North Carolina as we continue to grow the aviation industry, Cooper said. Right now, North Carolina ranks as the second fastest growing aerospace cluster in the United States. We now have 200 aerospace companies and 400 suppliers, and we're making the push for first, he says. The building will be the latest addition to the 133-acre Honda Aircraft Company campus at Piedmont Triad International Airport. The $15.5 million, 83,000 square foot expansion, bringing the company's total investment here to $245 million. The company employs about 1,500 of the 6,000 who work on the airport grounds. The new building, which will be built by Greensboro-based Samet Corporation, will manufacture wings for its growing fleet of jets, now flying some 130 around the world, including its popular 7-person Honda Jet Elite model. The building will also provide warehousing space for parts. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.